This is the Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy, 2020, Episode 3. Dr. Rob, it seems like forever since we've had a conversation, and again, we are continuing to our physical distancing as I am in the studio, you are on Skype. I know that elective surgeries have started back up again, so you probably feel good just getting to be a doctor again.
We just got rolling this past week, and there is a lot of stacked up surgeries. It's kind of one of those things when you've got an orthopedic problem. It's not like you're going to the doctor with something that's going to go away in 2 months. It's not one of those, like, you're going there for a reason. So it's these issues that people have orthopedically. I think we've got one surgeon who had like 120 surgeries.
Oh my God.
That they've been waiting to do. So we're in big time catch up mode right now. So we've been kind of burning the candle on both ends here to kind of get people helped out, get people going, and even that, it's still a very cautious process. So we're kind of rolling it out in different phases, and we're still just in phase one, and these phases are following guidelines from all the different surgical governing bodies, the National Anesthesia Governing Body. It's called the ASA, or American Society of Anesthesiologists. So the CDC, NIH, the state government, and the Douglas County Health mm-hmm. Department. All of them have these various sets of guidelines to follow, and we're kind of taking a very conservative approach in terms of which of these patients roll through first. It's got to be people who are healthy, not immunocompromised, anything like that. But even with those very conservative guidelines, man, it has been busy. So I like the work, though. It's nice getting out there and actually doing some stuff. So,
well, you know, you're lucky to go back to work, because I know a lot of people would like to. And I just want to take a minute to continue to recognize the sponsors of this podcast. I talked to Dave Remington. He was in Vermont for a long time. I think he's made his way back to New York now. But you know, he said, hey, the Remington Trophy, or not just the Remington Trophy, but the Boomer Esiason Foundation, has not been able to do a fundraiser since the Remington Trophy celebration. So you look at all these nonprofits.
Wow.
I know. You look at all these nonprofits that are trying to raise money, and this has definitely had an impact. You look at Scotty from Husker Hounds, who has not really been open. I know he opened yesterday, and we're recording on Saturday morning from like 9 to 3. It's impacted him. How about Ticket Express? There are no concerts. There are no sporting events. Chad, Jessica, the whole team at Ticket Express, we're thinking about you. Our thoughts are with you. And, of course, Infusion Brewing Company. They've been lucky because they can sell beer to go, which is really cool. But let's be honest, not really having people be able to go into your tap rooms and spend time in a bar has a major effect. So
I cannot wait to go out to a bar. Right? I hope I don't sound like an alcoholic saying that, but just to go someplace and have a beer with other people.
So
it's amazing. It's amazing how much you miss that stuff.
It really does. So please, if you get a second, go to the Boomer Esiason Foundation and drop in a donation if you can. If you can order on huskerhounds.com, please do so. If you want to order a gift certificate from Ticket Express, please do so. If you want to go get some beer from Infusion Brewing Company, please do so, because those guys have been with us really since the beginning of this podcast, and we want you to support them. And we appreciate them sticking with us, because these are tough times, and we're all going to get this through this together. Rob, the big news this past week is Keegan Johnson, the son of Cluster Johnson, a member of the 94-95 National Championship team. His son at Bellevue West has picked where he's going to go to school. That is the University of Iowa, which shocked many, many people. And there's been some brushback by fans, and some people have been supportive. I think people are shocked. I wasn't that surprised when I heard Keegan chose the University of Iowa. Were you?
I really wasn't either. You know, when you look at that situation in terms of recruiting in general, and you look at recruits today, and I know, you know, it's been interesting to me because I've had a little bit of, I guess I'd call it kind of like some inside insight on it, because my nephew's getting recruited by a number of schools, and he, Nebraska's one of them. Iowa recruited him. Wyoming, Kansas State. Actually, I think Virginia Tech's one of the schools that's been talking to him. That's kind of a little bit of a reach for them, but it's interesting when you look at kind of just sort of the lay of the land in college football right now. And I think about what appealed to me as a kid at the time. Now, obviously, I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. My dad worked for the university. So was I not going to go to Nebraska? Nah, probably not. I was definitely pretty locked in there, but that was my decision. And I was a huge Nebraska fan as a kid, and that was kind of the dream school for me. At the same time, though, I remember when Tom Osborne called to make that offer, I actually told him I needed to think about it. I think I made the guy wait a couple of weeks before I gave Osborne an answer. And this was at that time, we're talking 1989. And that was I gave him an answer. It's probably like late September or October of my senior year in high school, which in this day and age, that would be considered making a decision kind of late in the game. Back at that time period, that was incredibly early. Usually you didn't see guys making that verbal commitment until you got into like December or even January. Mm-hmm. Literally within weeks of signing day was when guys made that final commitment. So for me, that was actually a pretty early decision, but I still had to sit down and think about it for a couple of weeks to make sure I was making the right decision. But when you look at Nebraska, 1980s, 1990s, even say early 90s, prior to 93, 94, 95, when you looked at Nebraska, you had a program that one was insanely consistent from a winning standpoint. They were getting those 9-10 wins every year. They had a very stable and a very highly respected coaching staff. They had a great infrastructure, great strength program, athletic training, facilities. They had outstanding fan support. When I say that and think about that as that draw to Nebraska, because I remember people asking me, man, because I had scholarship offers, Stanford, UCLA, Washington, Ohio State, Michigan State, Iowa. There were some big time schools in that mix at the time I was coming out of high school. And when I thought about where I wanted to go, one of the things that stood out to me was that stability, that consistency, that I could look at Nebraska and say, you know what? Every year, I'm going to get that 9 or 10 wins. Every year, I'm going to at least have that chance to go to a title game, to contend for a title, whether it's a conference title, national title. You at least knew that shot was going to be there. Any of those 9-10 win a year programs nationwide, they're really only one, maybe two games away from a title contention. And that was the thing that really stood out about me with Nebraska. When I describe that right now, you're not describing the current state of Nebraska football. You're describing a program like Iowa. You're describing a program like Wisconsin. You're describing a program, Ohio State. When I say you're like two games away from title contention, Ohio State's a program that's always like one game away from a title contention. Same for like Alabama, Clemson, et cetera. But it's, if you've got a chance to get a scholarship to a program that's like that, that you're going to get that 9 or 10 wins every year, you're going to get, you're going to go to a place that's 1 or 2 games away from playing for a title of some type. That's what kids are looking for. And that's what I was looking for when I was coming out of high school.
You know, I had Cluster on my radio show on 1460 KXNO and 106.3 FM in Des Moines earlier this week, the day after Keegan decided to verbally commit to the University of Iowa. And I asked him, you know, just what was the difference was. And there's a couple things we're going to get into. But one thing that I thought was interesting that he brought up, really, maybe it comes down to the 9 and 10 wins per season, but it was also the stability. He said, you know, Keegan made his own decision, and he encouraged him to make his own decision. But he said when he visited with him, it reminded him a lot of Nebraska when he went there because of the stability and the family-like atmosphere.
Exactly. You've got that coaching staff that's been entrenched there for quite a while. You've got some very stable assistants. I didn't speak to Cluster, but he and I, we traded a bunch of messages on Twitter. We traded a bunch of text messages. And I think the stability was huge. That was something he mentioned to me as well, too. But that's exactly what I mean. When I look at the Nebraska that Cluster and I went to, we overlapped 4 years together. That was what we saw coming out of high school. It would have been stupid for us to not go to Nebraska when you looked at what Nebraska was at that point in time. Now, I say this from an athletic standpoint. I was proud of the education I got at Nebraska, still am. But let's be honest, it's not like I was looking at Nebraska and turning down Harvard, saying Nebraska's a much better academic institution.
You turned down Stanford.
I did. I turned down Rice. I had a scholarship offer to Rice. I turned down Rice. But a lot of it was because of football. It was because of the way the program was at that time. And when I look at Iowa right now, Iowa is Nebraska of 88 to 92, 93,
which is good. Not national championship caliber, but just really good.
But there's that chance that they're 1 or 2 games away from going to the Big Ten title game every year right now. And it's the Big Ten West is, there's a lot of parity in this division. I mean, all of a sudden, Minnesota's in the mix. Nebraska's trying to get there. They're not there yet. But, I mean, you look at Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa. It's a tough division. One of those three schools is going to go – they're going to get those 10 wins and the shot at that Big Ten title game every year, and have done it every year for the past several years. And that's what Nebraska is trying to get to. You go to the Big Ten title game and win it, all of a sudden you're going to have – somebody's going to have to make a comment about like, well, geez, do we let them into the playoff now?
Yeah.
Even if – I mean, if you've got a 2-loss Big Ten title game winner, that's somebody – somebody's – they're going to at least be in the conversation. If it's a 1-loss Big Ten title game winner, they're definitely in the conversation. So it's, I think Ohio State didn't, I'm trying to remember, did they have 2 losses?
When they won the
year they won the national title, first year of the playoff.
I'll have to go back and look.
I'm too many blows to the head. I'm forgetting now, but it's, if you're a 1 or 2 loss Big Ten title game winner, somebody's going to at least be in the conversation of, well, do they deserve a shot at going to the playoff? And if you're within that conversation, that's what kids are looking for. They want to be with the program, and that's what I mean by that. You're 1 or 2 games away from title contention. Is that if you're one of those programs that has that chance to go to a conference title game? If you, even if it's a couple of games away like Iowa's been the last couple of years, that's pretty impressive. And Iowa's going to bowl games. They're playing SEC schools and beating them in bowl games. And that says a lot to kids. So it's that kind of – you got to look at that kind of – I'm calling, it's facts of the matter. It's and so it's right now when you look at it, Clester's right. When Clester said it's not the Nebraska that we grew up with, that we saw coming out of high school, he's right. It's not. Now, I don't say that as a derogatory comment towards Scott Frost and his coaching staff down there. That's where they're trying to get to, but they're not there yet. It's been Frost he's 2 years without a bowl game, 3 years if you count that last year under Riley. They haven't turned that corner yet. Now, are they? Do I think they're building a foundation to get there? From where I'm at and the insight I have, yeah, I think they are moving in that direction. I think they're doing a good job of moving in that direction. From a developmental standpoint, a recruiting standpoint, a facilities development standpoint, yes, I absolutely think they are. But, I mean, I'm the guy who's been sitting here saying from day one, hey, this isn't going to be a 1 or 2 year turnaround like they had at UCF. It's just not. It's a different conference. It's a different set of opponents. It's the lay of the land is really different in the Big Ten West versus the AAC that they were in with UCF. They had a whole different set of athletes. I mean, Central Florida's been putting guys into the NFL, at least a few guys every year through the NFL draft since Frost hit the door at UCF. They had athletes there when Frost hit the door, and those guys are now going to the NFL. He had a lot more to work with. We're giddy about the fact that we had two guys drafted in what, the sixth or seventh round? And that's another thing about Iowa. Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's
going
fine.
On my freaking 10-minute rant here, but that's the other thing that kids are looking at is what school has that track record of putting guys into the NFL? And Iowa's, you know, are they University of Florida? Are they Alabama? Are they LSU? Are they Ohio State? No, but they're kind of about one step back from that. They're a program that every year they're going to put a handful of guys into the NFL. And it's not sixth and seventh round draft picks. It's first and second and third round draft picks. Iowa puts a lot of guys in the NFL. The NFL loves whatever Ferentz is doing over there. The NFL loves it. And these guys are going to NFL teams. They're making the teams. They're sticking around and they're playing. And that's what one of the other things that kids want to see. Is they want to see a program that can get them ready for the NFL. And that's something, I mean, you look at, I mean, Avante Dickerson, highest ranked recruit in Nebraska right now. My son's a teammate of his. He's going to Minnesota. Part of the reason he liked it is within 3 years, God, Fleck drives me nuts, but he's built this program up. He's got this air of stability and family up there. And all of a sudden, Minnesota's putting guys into the NFL. And when Avante was looking at where to go, that was one of the things he wanted to see. It was a program that puts guys into the NFL. And so you look at Iowa. God, it's almost disgusting how good they've been at putting guys into the NFL. It's somewhat frustrating as an observer because I always think they ought to They should have, instead of 9 or 10 wins every year, I think Ferentz should have 11 or 12 every year, but that's just my opinion.
Well, but the difference is those NFL guys are defensive backs, they're tight ends, and they're offensive linemen. They, you know, it's not the quarterback, it's not the skill position, it's not even the wide receivers or the running back. So, and that can be the difference between, you know, that 11 and 12 wins. You better watch it, though, because people are going to think you're talking way too much about Iowa, not enough about Nebraska on this Husker Doc Talk podcast. And to answer your question, Ohio State was 14-1 in 2014.
Okay, that was when they had that loss to Virginia Tech early in the year.
Yep,
okay.
Yep.
Which still, there's been years where there's been a two-loss Big Ten champ, and they haven't gone to the playoff, but then the discussion that always triggers is, hey, should we expand that playoff to 6 teams, 8 teams, 10 teams, because should we really have the Big Ten title winner, the Pac-12 title winner, not in the playoff? And my answer is like, yeah, you should have them in the playoff. So anyway, we're kind of tangenting here. But the thing is, though, I just think that if you're upset about the fact that Keegan Johnson didn't go to Nebraska, I think you're a little tone deaf to what the facts of the matter are. I mean, and here's the other thing. So Keegan's class of 2021, he'll graduate high school next spring. Depending on what happens this fall, COVID-19 and all, we'll see what happens. But again, we're in a situation here where at least if you're looking at the last few years, Keegan was in what? Sixth grade?
Yeah.
When fifth or sixth grade, the last time Nebraska beat Iowa. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, you're asking a kid to say, which program are you going to pick? And odds are he doesn't remember the last time Nebraska beat Iowa.
I think what plays into factor here, and I'm going to get into the Iowa-Nebraska recruiting thing because Nebraska fans shouldn't be that upset, but I got a lot to ask here. But I think what plays into to play here is C.J. Johnson, who went to Wyoming to play for Craig Bohl, was not recruited by the Pelini staff. Now, I don't think there may have been a grudge there, but I think what happened here is, you know, Keegan's brother, he's got two that play in college football, CJ at Wyoming, the other one's at South Dakota State. I think what happens here is when you get away, you see that you can be happy somewhere else too, right? I mean, you can go somewhere else and it's not, you can go, oh, I can go away from home and still be successful. Don't you think that plays a little part of it?
I think it plays a huge part in it. And you look at both CJ and Cade and what they've done. I mean, Cade's up at South Dakota State, correct?
Yep.
So you look at what he's 2-time All-American. I don't know if he had a chance. I mean, one of the things that made people really doubt Minnesota last fall of 2019 was the game Minnesota played against South Dakota State, where South Dakota State essentially just nuked Minnesota and lost the game because of a couple of penalties and a freshman quarterback who turned the ball over literally like 5 or 6 times that day.
Yep.
Otherwise, South Dakota State marched up and down the field all game long on Minnesota, and one of the guys who did the most damage was one of Clester's sons, who's now a 2-time All-American up there. And I mean, and heck, he even had I think it was a 95-yard kickoff return for a touchdown called back because of one of the worst clipping calls I've ever seen in my life. It was a ticky-tack clip, and it happened completely on the other side of the field behind where Johnson already was. So, I mean, it was a legit 95-yard touchdown run that he made it happen himself, and it got called back. So, I mean, not only did he light up Minnesota, he had plays called back that would have made it even uglier for Minnesota. So he's done great up there. And you know what? Here's the thing. I kind of understand a little bit as a father if you feel like you got slighted because you got a kid who was having a really solid career at Wyoming. He had a CJ had a really devastating knee injury that essentially kind of ended his senior year before it started. But he was playing really well. It's one of those things. I get it. Recruiting's, in hindsight, it's 2020. He could have played at Nebraska and would have done well at Nebraska. Cade could have played and would have done very well at Nebraska. And I think that was part of the reason why Keegan got offered as a junior in high school is because, like, keep in mind, Frost didn't have the chance to recruit the first two. I mean, that would have, that was under Riley's staff and that was under Pelini's staff. But Frost offered Keegan because he could look at CJ and Cade and go, these guys are lighting it up and have shown they can perform at a really high level. Don't make a mistake the third time. So they offered Keegan. It's just, again, I think it's Keegan looked at what he thought was going to be best for him. So and he did that. And I guess you know, you mentioned Clester. I can see Clester being a little ticked off about the fact that Pelini's staff didn't recruit CJ and Riley's staff didn't recruit Cade. I understand that. I mean, from a family member standpoint, that's one of those things where you look at the situation and you're like, yeah, if the kid can play and you think he can play and he's an in-state kid, I think there's definite value from the program to make that offer and try and keep those in-state kids. It bothered me when Seth Olson left Millard North to go to Iowa, when Shada left Millard North to go to Iowa. I mean, when you had those local guys leaving to go to other schools, yeah, it bothered me. But at the time, again, those guys were looking at a situation, same as Keegan, and going, hey, I think this is a more stable program. This is a program that's winning more games, is putting guys into the NFL, more so than the school that's just down the road.
So what do you say to, and I believe it's the vocal minority that gets on Twitter and the criticism that comes at an in-state kid that leaves?
What do I say to those people?
Yeah.
I think you're, well, a couple of things. One, where you go to college is an incredibly personal choice. It's not one of these things where you base it off of where the fans think you ought to go. There's the relationship that you have with the coaching staff, the relationship you have with the other recruits. That's huge right there. And that's something that's grown even more. Now, I knew a number of the guys that Nebraska was recruiting in the same class I was in. But it's not like it is today where these kids are interacting left and right on Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, et cetera. These guys are, you're whipping out your cell phone and calling these guys up and having conversations. We didn't have that ability back in the 1980s. It didn't exist. And so those relationships with the other recruits that you build up play a huge role in all of this. The state of the program themselves. I think kids are just as apt to leave any home school, home state program now more so than ever. And I think that's different. I mean, if you grew up just down the road from Lincoln, you're going to go to Lincoln. It was weird when Larry Station went to Iowa. It was weird when Junior Bryant went to Notre Dame. It was, I guarantee you, for the Iowa and Iowa State people, when the Craig brothers left Iowa to go play football at Nebraska, that was, that jolted people over there a bit. Like, why would you leave the state of Iowa? And that's something that I think people don't think about. That dynamic has changed over the last 15, 20, 25 years. You just don't have that anymore. I mean, it used to be really unusual. Even when Nebraska maybe wasn't winning national titles, it was very unusual for an in-state kid to go to some other school. And that's just not the case now. I mean, you look, take Wandale Robinson. I mean, he actually committed to Kentucky. That was what, like 35 minutes away from where he grew up. That was the home state school. And they've been playing good football there recently. They've been getting recruits. They've been making waves here in the SEC as a school that's kind of on the rise. We managed to get him out of a commitment to Kentucky. You look at all these kids from Florida that are getting recruited by Florida State, by Miami, by University of Florida, that are coming up here to Nebraska, for instance. You look at the kids from Texas that you get out of the state of Texas. You get the kids out of California. It's not that big a deal, I think, to leave your home state, to leave that hometown school. I mean, if we win a recruiting war with Texas or Texas A&M or Texas Tech for a kid from Texas, it's not like as Nebraska fans we're sitting there going, whew, this kid's an absolute traitor for leaving Texas and coming here.
Well, it's funny that
if a kid leaves Nebraska to go someplace else, you all of a sudden feel personally slighted as a fan, and I think that's bullshit.
Well, it's interesting you say that because Nebraska fans could soon be celebrating because the top two players in the state of Iowa, Thomas Fedone, who's the tight end at Council Bluffs Lewis Central, and TJ Bowlers at Clear Creek Amana, whose father also played at the University of Iowa, are both Nebraska's in the running for both. Bowlers has said he's basically not going to Iowa.
He already said he's not going there.
So he's down to Wisconsin and Nebraska. And then Fedone, who's a hell of a tight end. And right now, if you're a tight end, where would you want to go to school? And Nebraska seems to be the top choice of Fedone. So, that's just the way it goes in today's world. And I just – it cracks me up when people criticize somebody for making a decision. And we've heard it say, well, Cluster should have told his son where to go. Rob, you and I
– You can't.
You and I have children that are older. And we know that if you tell your kid to do something – it's going to end badly, right? It is.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, well, as a parent, I don't want to be the one making the decision. I want them to be able to have, I mean, there's some stuff where you're looking at colleges and it's one of these things where like, okay, you've got your top three and boy, you know what? This one over here is an out-of-state school that, or is a private school that, cost of attendance is over $70,000 a year, and over here is a state university that's out-of-state tuition is less than a third of that. Maybe you ought to look at that one. If it's in your top three, let's go to that one. Like, you can give some, but that's just good advice. You don't want to graduate college with $200,000 in student loan debt. That's not telling a kid where they have to go. That's just teaching your kid economics is what that is. I want my kid to make that decision. I want them to go where they feel they have a good fit. And I think that's one of the things that's hugely, hugely important here with these decisions. And if you're a fan who doesn't understand that you think it's purely, well, you're an in-state kid and your dad played football for Nebraska, you should be telling your kid that's where you need to go. I mean, my kids know I'm a huge Nebraska fan. I get irate when you walk through the room too loudly when I'm watching a Nebraska football game or basketball game or baseball game, volleyball game. I love Nebraska. I love Nebraska athletics. Don't bug me when I'm watching a Nebraska sporting event. It's my kids know that. I do not expect my kids to pick Nebraska for higher education if they feel like they've got a better fit someplace else, whether it's for academics, sports, whatever. I've got my nephew who plays for Elkhorn South. I do not if Nebraska offers him a scholarship and he feels he's got a better fit someplace else, I do not expect him to go someplace else. I know for a fact, talking with my brother, that my nephew has said, hey, he kind of said the same thing. John told me he said the same thing that Keegan told Clester. It's not the same program as it was when John and I were in high school, when Clester was in high school. I've heard the same thing from my nephew, that he's going to go where he feels like he's got a good fit. He's going to go where he feels like he's wanted.
Before we pick up that conversation, I do want to say, I noticed on Twitter the other day, when you can follow Dr. Rob on at Doc Talk Sports, Jack Stark is getting into the political game, man.
He is running for regent.
I think that's a great – I mean, I don't know anybody who's as passionate about the university, and maybe I'm just looking from an athletic standpoint, but Jack has meant so much to the state of Nebraska, the Nebraska Athletic Department, and now the Creighton Athletic Department, because he does a lot of work with Bruce Rasmussen and all the coaches over there. But he has given so much to the state, and here's another way – for Jack to give back. Jack's a great guy. I mean, he's always been good to me. Even after I got out of the television business, we've kept in touch somewhat, and he's just a salt of the earth, man.
Oh, very much. I mean, he's a Hastings guy, grew up in the state. He's been on the faculty at both Creighton and UNMC. God, I credit him a huge amount. When I was coming out of pro football and wanted to go back to medical school, I'd been away from it for 6 years at that point in time. God, he was the first guy I called up. I was like, hey, I want to football career is winding down. I probably ought to go to med school now. I need your help. What should I do in terms of kind of get my ducks in a row to reapply to medical school? And he was the guy who helped me with that. But he's a brilliant guy. You look at what he did. I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before, the stuff he did in terms of forming the Unity Council. So he was originally brought on as, I don't know if he was the first. I think he might have been the first sports psychologist brought on board by Nebraska's athletic department. And this would have been really like the real late 1980s, 88, 89, 90, maybe. And he kind of came in and took a look around that, and he worked with all sports down there. But he was really, really instrumental in kind of a big culture change we had down at the university in terms of, I hate saying this, I mean, extended everywhere from race relations to kind of forming sort of an integrated disciplinary council on the team to kind of handle disciplinary actions, things like that. And it was one of the things that really made us as a team accountable to each other. And Jack was the guy who created that culture. And, you know, you look at what Nebraska did there in the 1990s, where Osborne went essentially 20 years before he finally kind of really turned that corner and had that complete team and kind of put together the big picture that turned into that 5-year run from 93 through 97. That was something that Jack was hugely, hugely instrumental in. And so I just, you know, the fact that he's running, I've got a lot of, I don't get political too much, but I've got a lot of passion for him for this, because he's a guy that I think what he brings to the table is going to be really interesting on an actual governing body like the Board of Regents in terms of the culture that he can instill both within that group the board itself, but as well at the university as a whole. And I think the thing is, you don't want to get too wrapped up in just the athletic side of this and Jack's background within athletics, the sports world, NASCAR, et cetera. The guy's an academician. I mean, this is a guy who's highly published within the field of psychology. This is a guy who's this is a guy who's been on both the admissions committees for UNMC and Creighton Medical Schools. This is a guy who's been on faculty at both Creighton and UNMC. The academic side of it, the administrative understanding that he has as a faculty member at both institutions is going to be huge, will be huge on the Board of Regents for Nebraska.
So when you go to the polls on May 12th, vote for Jack Stark. It's our recommendation. It is our endorsement, the Husker Doc Talk podcast endorsement of Jack Stark for the Nebraska Board of Regents. You mentioned your nephew. I know he was offered at Montana State, and he hasn't been offered at Nebraska yet. I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of those walk-ons who committed to Nebraska a couple of years ago enter the transfer portal and decide they want to go play. Rob, you and I have had this discussion a long time. Back when the walk-on program was strong, the strength of Division I AA schools or FCS schools or even Division II schools isn't what it is today. You mentioned Cade up at South Dakota State. You can go up there, compete for national titles, and also make it to the National Football League.
Yeah, there's so much interplay, too, between those schools and 1A schools as well, too.
So,
and they're going to be televised. I mean, you're going to be able to sit down and watch South Dakota State play Minnesota on national TV.
And the step down isn't that far, especially when you look at the better FCS schools. The difference there is depth. But I think what we're seeing here is guys want to play. And if they don't want to play sparingly or on special teams, they want to play. So are you surprised at some of these guys going, you know what, I'm out of here?
No, I'm not. And I think one of the guys, Forbes, one of the old linemen, he was very adamant about the fact that this wasn't a strike against Nebraska. He just saw an opportunity to play elsewhere. And I think he had kind of hoped, hey, let me get down there, see what happens. If I can bust into a consistent playing role right away, because there's a number of walk-ons that get down there and some of these guys get some playing time right away. And it's like, hey, that's awesome for them. I think he was in a position where he's looking at the offensive line at Nebraska right now, especially with some of the other younger guys coming up. When you look at like an Ethan Piper, you look at a Bryce Benhart, you look at a Juergens, who's only going to be a sophomore this fall. I think he just looked at the situation and he was looking around the O-line room going, hey, here's where I'm sitting on the depth chart right now. I'm not going to have that opportunity to play. And if I go someplace else, I could potentially, you go to even another Division I school. I mean, there's other schools he could go to and potentially play much earlier than he would at Nebraska. There's 1AA Division II schools he could probably start at right away. And I think that's kind of what these kids are looking at. I'll be interested to see, because one of the dynamics of the Scott Frost staff this first 2.5 years has been that huge ramp up in the walk-on program. And there's a lot of these local guys who are really, really good athletes. And again, I look at guys that are close to home for me. So take Grant Taggy, for instance, who was an all-state linebacker for Westside this past year, who's walking on at Nebraska. And that's been his dream school his whole life, has been to go play for Nebraska. I'm happy as heck for Grant. At the same time, that's a kid who's a really, really good athlete who could play ball right away at a lot of other schools. I'll be curious to see once he gets down there, whether they have him at safety or linebacker, if he's in a position that, if he's not getting a lot of snaps right away, is that the kind of kid that might potentially do the same thing and go like, hey, even though this was my dream school, man, I could go to a Wyoming, a North Dakota State, maybe a Kansas State, and play right away. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out for all of these walk-ons, because some of these walk-ons are really, really good athletes, very, very good football players. And are they going to get down there? It's going to be a heck of a crowded position room, and they're not going to get much playing time. I think you might see kind of a little bit of a trend here, kind of like what you're seeing with Forbes and some of these other walk-ons, where they're going to get down there. They're going to have a great experience. Nebraska is going to be very, very good to them. They're going to like the coaching staff. They're going to like the teammates. It's just after a year or two, it's going to turn into this situation of like, crap, I can go over here and get more playing time. And you're going to see guys making this decision with a degree of consistency.
So let's shift gears now to coronavirus, because you're a doctor, you're on the front lines. Do you think college football takes place in the fall? If it does, are there fans in the stadium?
I think it does. I was going to say, I'm kind of the forever optimist for a lot of things, and I'm really optimistic it will. I have a hard time. I mean, you look at a lot of these pandemics. We haven't seen one that lasts on a global scale for an extensive period of time. You see them last. I mean, Ebola kind of hangs out endemically down in Africa, but you don't see it getting out of there much. SARS stayed fairly localized in certain regions. MERS stayed fairly localized in certain regions. But you tend to see these things kind of, they tend to not last. And we're talking about this like it's going to be this potential 9-month, 12-month, 18-month process before we quote unquote get over coronavirus. And it's hard for me to imagine this sticking around. At some point, a few things are going to happen. A, you're going to find a vaccine that actually works fairly well and gets put out on the market, and people are going to get vaccinated for it. B, there's going to be a degree of herd immunity that gets developed. Enough people get it, develop some antibodies. Now, there's been a lot of reports where people have gotten coronavirus, gotten over it, and gotten it again. Now, I have the interesting thing is even within the medical community, I haven't seen a lot of reports on the people who've been infected and gotten it again. I haven't seen a lot of info on, well, are those people who've gotten it a second time, are they as sick? Are they being hospitalized? Are they getting it, surviving it the first time and then dying the second time? Was the first time they got it, was it mild symptoms, bit of a cough and loss of sense of smell for a few weeks? And then the second time it was, maybe they got fever for 2 days and that was it. I don't know. That information has not really filtered out much. And so we haven't seen much of that. But what would be interesting is, as we continue to ramp up this testing process, is find out how many people, A, have it and or have had it, and are we actually building kind of a herd immunity where if 70-80% of the population, we find out, which some of these extrapolation testings they're doing where are finding an oddly high number of people have in fact had it and never knew it.
I got back from Italy in December, and dude, I was laid up for a month. It was horrible.
And that's the thing, is that I think there's a lot of people who have kind of been in that situation who have potentially had this disease, and don't know, had no idea they had it. There's some people who had it and know they had it, even without the testing. They're just like, yeah, I totally had it. Yeah. But I think there's a lot of people sitting back there going like, geez, you know, like mid late March, I had that. Kind of like felt like I was fighting the flu for about 2 days and then I was better. You know, I kind of had sort of a mild cold for a week there in early April. You kind of wonder if that was coronavirus.
Yeah. Have you been tested?
So I have not. Now, I mean, I think the worst I had is, I mean, and I haven't even really had much of a cold. I got my normal run of seasonal allergies that I get every spring, but nothing out. Nothing. I don't even take Zyrtec for that. So, but my wife had kind of about 2 to 3 days. I mean, it didn't even hang on longer than that. She had about 2 to 3 days of kind of some mild flu-like symptoms. My oldest daughter had a sore throat for a week. But that was it. I mean, within the family. But I never had enough symptoms that would have warranted the testing. If I'd had the symptoms as a healthcare worker, I would have been able to get the test. But at this point now, I never had enough symptomatology to be able to get tested.
Well, I think the interesting part about this whole thing and turning it now not into a medical thing but a business thing is that I hope people understand what the concept of cash flow means to a lot of businesses and how fragile even the mega powers that were the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, and yes, college athletics, because everybody thought college athletics was sitting on a mountain of money. And Nebraska has a slush fund, but many other schools do not. Do you think this is a wake-up call?
Even for the schools with the slush fund.
Yeah.
You burn through that pretty quick.
So do you think this is a wake-up call to we're going to see the end of the big time contracts for coaches? Do you think NBA, NFL players, these big time contracts in the millions upon millions are over because of how fragile the system can be?
I don't think it'll be over, but I think you're going to see more of a cap put on stuff. I don't think you're going to see the continued escalation of them going up and up and up and up and up. I think that's going to, I think that talk about flattening a curve. That's a curve that's going to get flat.
And should be, right?
Because of this. Well, I'm one of those guys. It's kind of one of those, whatever the market.
Yeah.
Bears,
supply. And, yeah, that's true. Cause I've never faulted anybody for making money. I always hated people. So, you make too much money. No, he did not. Or he or she does not make too much money. There's no such thing.
For a college football coach, or I shouldn't even say that. I'm neglecting everybody. Any college sports coach at whatever level, man, you gotta love that job. It is a nasty lifestyle. I mean, it's bad. It just is. You've got to love the job, and you've got to really, really dedicate yourself A, to the job, but also you really got to take care of your family, because the time commitments, the work commitments, it's really, really a tough job. It is not an easy decision, and you've got to handle so many different situations. There's so many hats you got to wear. Look at Scott Frost, for instance, with who was it, Legrone and the other football player, the two guys with the sexual assault charges against him. Now, you've now got a Title IX lawsuit. Yeah. That's been filed. And actually, I say it's a Title IX lawsuit. It's a lawsuit against the university for the Title IX committee failing to address issues. So and Scott Frost is taking blame on this. And he's the guy who, when he found out about it, suspended these two guys as soon as he knew. So you've got those kind of issues that you have to deal with. You've got social issues, you've got legal issues, all of it being heavily covered by the media. The time commitments alone, both coaching as well as recruiting, both following up academically, you've got this 150 plus group of people, and everybody expects you to have perfect 100% tabs on what's happening in the lives of one of those, of each and every one of those 150 plus guys, and keeping tabs on everybody affected by each of one of those 150 plus guys. I mean, it's kind of mind blowing to me. I sit back and I think, like, God, the last thing I think I would like to be right now is a head football coach for a college football team. I would not want to touch that job with a 10-foot pole. The number of hats you got to wear and the amount of work that's involved and the media scrutiny you live under. I don't fault the guys for wanting to make $3 to $5 million a year. In my mind, that makes sense when I look at what these guys have to put up with.
So I've talked to a couple coaches about, you know, getting back into the game of college football, because you got to remember, summer workouts now are like non-existent. You're sending your guys workouts, hoping they're doing them. So you're missing that camaraderie and team building during the season. Coach,
it'll be interesting if the season does start. It's going to be interesting to see I always call it the quality of the product you see on the field, because even you can have teams that are winning 9, 10, 12 games playing for titles this fall and have it still look kind of sloppy.
Well, and it probably – this will play advantage to the teams that have a lot of guys coming back in depth. But does this sound about right? If the season were to start, coaches have told me you're going to need 2 to 3 weeks just alone with strength and conditioning to get you back into shape to start practice. So, and then you're going to need at least four weeks of practice before that first game. So you're looking at maybe 7 to 8 weeks total. So you've got the strength and conditioning part, and that's all you do, and then transition to the practice. Does that sound about right? So you're looking at about a July 1 start date, right, to make things work?
Yeah, and that sounds pretty – I mean, that sounds very feasible. And no, I shouldn't say feasible. That makes sense in my mind of what you would need to have.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to have for this to happen. You can't just show up August 20th and start rolling into practice. It's going to be a mess, and I think guys are going to be dropping like flies, although it's kind of what we did back in high school. Well, I did, but that's what most high school teams used to do back in the day. But that's the thing. It's interesting how many of these guys have been putting themselves through workouts, how many of these guys have access to facilities they can use. And that I don't know. I mean, I don't even know the answer to the question. Hey, if I was a Nebraska football player, could I get into Memorial Stadium to go run stadium stairs? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what facilities guys have available. So, it's hard to say. I mean, I've got a son who's a high school athlete, a daughter who's on a college rowing team, a younger daughter who actually wrestles, plays football, and plays volleyball. And I don't want to say it's been a struggle, but I mean, we'll go driving around town and we'll find high school football stadiums that are open to go run stadium stairs. We'll go find a big hill at a park when the parks are open and go run hills. I mean, the combination of push-up exercises that I've come up with, all the different push-up routines that I've come up with, is mind-blowing at this point. trying to keep kids in shape. I mean, we've been going up to the high school, and the high school field's been open periodically. We're doing pull-ups, the big, huge regulation-size soccer nets. We've been going to those and using that as our pull-up bar. I mean, it's...
You're going all Rocky IV here, aren't you?
Oh, hardcore. I mean, it's like we're training for the big Russian up in Siberia right now. So I think I've taken my son out to... We've got a fishing cabin up off the Platte River.
Yeah, you go ahead and call that a cabin. You go ahead and call that a cabin.
It's a nice cabin.
Fucking cabin.
But we'll go up there, and it's I bought a used Polaris Ranger, like the big utility, not ATV vehicle, but like the utility size ones. It's got the little mini pickup truck bed so I can haul sand and logs and stuff. And there's about a 200-yard dirt sand path that runs from where the cabins and houses are at down to the Platte River. And it's completely flat. I mean, I'll have him push that 200 yards down the path one way, push that thing 200 yards back up the path. We'll find like 30-pound rocks, and I'll have him go out on a 50-yard-long sandbar, and he's got to take the rock, pick it up, and basically clean and jerk a 30-pound rock, shot put it through the air as far as he can, walk over, pick it up, do it again, 50 yards down, 50 yards back. I mean, it's literally work boot and gloves workouts that you're putting these kids through. And I know a lot of the other kids are doing the same kind of stuff. So,
well, you got to get creative, because I'm not going to call this the new normal. I heard Dan Patrick call it the new abnormal, because I think that's what it is. Hopefully we do get back to normal. I somebody asked me the other day if I could go to a bar right now and have a drink, would I? And the answer is yes. Would you? If it was with me.
How crowded is the bar?
I don't know. It's just, let's say you and I went up to Benson to Infusion Brewing Company and sat in a corner.
Yeah, I mean, it's that closeness, and it's the number of people. Kind of the primary determinant of all of this is numbers of people in close proximity. That's what determines the spread. And if you can limit that, so truth be told, given my job, and
that's true.
Part of my job is to not get sick.
Yes.
Because if I get sick, I'm out for the duration of the illness, and then I'm out for another minimum like 14 to 21 days after that. And so it's part of my, like I said, that, I mean, that I can't say it any better way. Part of my job is to not get sick. So when I go out, it's sparse. I go to the grocery store at weird times to avoid crowds. I'm wearing a mask. I have like the little pocket-sized bottle of Purell hand gel. I walk through a grocery store, I'm Purelling my hands literally like every 7 minutes as I walk through a grocery store. It's the things I go through to keep myself from getting sick, because I have to. So, I mean, do I want to? Oh my God. The idea of taking my family out to eat at a restaurant and letting somebody else fill the beer glass, bring food to the table, and just hang out, talk. And I mean, you can do it at home. It's just sometimes it's nice to go out.
Absolutely.
God, I miss that. I do. I miss having my kids get together with a whole bunch of friends. That's the kind of thing that just, that part of this is so, it's painful. I mean, from a psychological standpoint, and I understand that, but.
So you're not, are you letting your oldest, because I let my oldest son go out. I can't, I mean, he lives here, but he's old. So I let him leave. Do you let your kids leave?
Yeah, I let them leave the house, but I mean, it's even, they understand the situation. They understand it with me as well. So they kind of keep it under control. And yeah. So, my daughter's got a handful of friends that she'll go bike riding around the neighborhood, and you see these, like this group of like four or five kids all on bikes, all spaced out like 18 feet apart or whatever.
Yeah.
And she's had some other friends that she's hung out with, but again, it's one of those, I know the parents, I know those kids and those parents have not left their home for X amount of time, that they've been kind of quarantining as well. And so you kind of try and follow some degree of safeguards while you do this. I know some of my son's buddies are getting together and with the opening, the quote unquote reopening this week, a group of guys started getting together to do some workouts together, like outdoor running stuff. It's not like they're crowded into a weight room. They're outside, and they're spacing themselves out. Even that, I've told him, hey, we need to still give it another week or so here just to see how this reopening affects the numbers. I can't risk getting sick. So,
and well, you sound healthy now, and it's always healthy to have a good conversation. Next time, you know, I'm pretty safe, and I can keep you 6 feet away from me in the studio. So I need to get you over here and have a beer. I actually think my wife misses you in your long, deep conversations about medicine and genetics.
Make sure you take care of her for Mother's Day tomorrow.
Oh shit, I forgot about that.
Oh, you're killing me, dude.
All right, buddy. It's always good talking to you. Let's hook up again soon. The last time we record is March 28th, and it's May 9th now.
Ooh, we need to do this more often.
Yeah, we should.
So.
And the Saturday morning thing kind of worked out, didn't it?
It did. I like it. Drinking coffee you had a photo of your coffee pot.
Yeah, that's an
on the stove.
That's an Italian percolator. It's really kind of
is
nice.
Is that pewter? What's that made out of?
Just regular like metal. It's not pewter. I don't know if it's steel or what. I don't know what it is. But
that looks badass.
It is badass, and it makes a really nice, smooth, strong cup of coffee.
Oh, I bet.
I think you can even pick one up at like TJ Maxx if you head up there. I don't know if it's open.
Seriously?
Yet. Yeah, yeah.
I'll have my wife throw her PPP on or PPE on and run into TJ Maxx with the Purell then. So.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you next time. Always good talking to you, Dr. Rob. Don't forget, you can always follow Dr. Rob on Twitter at DocTalkSports. If you have a question for Dr. Rob or myself that you'd like to have answered on this podcast, you can always email us, DocTalkSports@gmail.com. Make sure to patronize and thank our sponsors, the Remington Trophy, along with the Boomer Esiason Foundation, Ticket Express, Husker Hounds, and Infusion Brewing Company. Because without those great businesses and supporters, this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for tuning into this edition of the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy. We'll be back soon with another edition.